open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I remember that moment. It's like, I have to go in and tell the priest the bad stuff I did. I don't want to tell him the real bad stuff I did. So I had to lie to the priest.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, novelist Colin McCann talks about his life, his art, and the philosophy behind them.
I think the real value of an optimist is to be able to deal with the cynic. So to be open to his or her pessimism and be able to beat them at their own pessimism, leave them there and walk away from it and just say, I'm going somewhere new, because it's really no great revelation that the world is dark and that bad things happen. The true revelation is that you can get something out of the darkness.
Colin McCann came to the U.S. from Ireland in the early 1980s. His fiction has appeared in many publications, including The New Yorker, Esquire, GQ, and The Atlantic Monthly. McCann himself has been a guest on a number of national public radio programs. He's the author of 5 novels, including his newest, Transatlantic. McCann starts our hour talking with guest host Lee Haber, books editor at O Magazine, about his friendship with another well-known Irish author, the late Frank McCourt.
Frank was in a hospice on 92nd Street and 3rd Avenue, and he wasn't well. But he'd lived such a fantastic life, and his voice had gone. And I went into the room, and he's laying there in bed, and he calls me across, and he goes, "Big shot." And but he taught me humility. Actually, one of the things I was writing things down to him, and I used to go out in the town with him and his wife Ellen and my wife Alison, and we used to go dancing and singing and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. And I wrote down on the piece of paper, when and where are you going to go dancing now? And he wrote down every Sabbath, and next Sabbath, which was true because he was dead the next weekend. Next Sabbath, I will go dancing upstairs with the great JC and the Mary M and the 12 hot boys. And then he wrote, and I think this is the last thing that Frank McCourt ever wrote in his hand. He said, "And in the morning, all will be forgiven."
Wow.
So, you look at somebody like that who had huge success and was able to keep it in check. And you just learn to develop humility, I think.
He kind of came out of nowhere, really, in terms of the writer scene. But you've been really toiling away.
Right.
And, gradually gaining audience, but then suddenly kind of bursting into, the scene in a really amazing way.
Well, 20 years ago, maybe 22 years ago, when my first book came out, I remember I'd been living in Japan and I was going to London, and my first collection of stories, Fish in the Slowback River, was about to come out. And so I had my torn black overcoat.
Which, by the way, you have to read.
Oh, it's
Is it going to be on an e-book soon?
Which?
Made into an e-book soon?
The collection? I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. Yeah. So I had a torn black overcoat and a really naff-looking beret, and I was going to go in, and I thought everybody was going to turn around and say, "Oh, congratulations." And so I went up to the offices, and absolutely nothing happened.
Oh.
And I was like, "Oh, this is terrible, this is terrible, this is what publishing is like." But at the far end of the corridor, a door opened, and this beautiful lady with long raven red hair came out of the office, and she took sympathy on me, and she'd actually read my book. That woman was Edna O'Brien.
Oh.
And that evening, she invited me to go for a reading with her, as sort of the warm-up act for a reading. And that sort of generosity that moves through the writing community is sort of extraordinary.
You're absolutely right. I mean, just to digress a little bit, in the upcoming issue of our magazine, the July summer reading issue, I asked a couple of writers to kind of curate their categories, like memoir and suspense fiction and so on. And people like Gillian Flynn contributed. And what she was essentially doing was picking out writers whose new books are coming out and talking about their books. And the generosity of the 3 writers who curated, just amazing.
Right.
Yeah, there really is a community.
Maybe it was interesting like 40 years ago when the likes of Norman Mailer were having fist fights in the restaurants and things like that.
The Lion's Head.
I haven't had a fist fight recently. I'm going to have to do one. Not here, not tonight.
I read somewhere that you said a writer should write about things that might possibly break you.
Mm.
What about your new book has the capacity to do that, and why is that an important element?
Well, I think the inexecutable is one of the things that we should all be interested in. And so the possibility of failing is and pushing ourselves to the limit, whether it be in writing or in athletics or in, you know, in family life or whatever else that you can do, you push yourself to the edge. I like the excellence of difficulty. And so when I embarked on this book, I was actually, when I wrote Let the Great World Spin, I was completely terrified, to be honest. What am I going to do next, you know? And I was working on this book that was set in New York, and it was about video surveillance, and I kind of hated it. It was awful. And I was obsessed by this idea of Frederick Douglass going to Ireland in 1845. And you all know who Frederick Douglass is, the African-American abolitionist. But he was still a slave in 1845 when he arrived in Ireland to go on lecture tour. And I thought, I really want to write about that. And I kept trying it, and I kept failing. But it was that thing in the back of my mind that I really wanted to do, and then eventually I
so
went
that was
out.
The kernel of the new book? That's what really began it?
That was
because
the kernel.
Because that's the second, for those of you who haven't yet read it, that's the second part of the book.
Right.
Various characters are introduced, so why don't you just expand on that a little?
What Jill said earlier was, I wanted the book to take on that particular period, because I think it was a fascinating period, that, you know, Douglas goes to Ireland and he bumps up against the famine. And it hadn't really been written about. But a novel has to be sort of relevant to the present day as well. And I was looking at Irish history and thinking, like, it's time for me to go home. And I was always fascinated also by another great American statesman, Senator George Mitchell, the senator from Maine who was Speaker of the House for 6 years. And he went to Ireland and negotiated our peace process over the course of 2 years. Now, he was 64 years old. He was retired. He had a 5-month-old son with a new wife. And he still went across to Ireland and listened to us go on and rattle on like
and
for 800 years.
And what did he get paid for that role, by the way? Nothing, right?
Nothing. And he'd sit there and listen to us blather on about, well, they did this to us in, 1619, and he came over here, and like, point of order, Mr. Chairman, let me tell you something. And he sat there silently, and then he struck at the right time. And I think he did an extraordinary thing, like one of the great stories of the end of the 20th century, certainly in Irish history, if not in everyone's history. And America had a big role to play in this, because it was Bill Clinton who asked Senator Mitchell to go across. But America has always been really important to the Irish imagination and the sense of possibility, you know, that we go across, that we come here and do something new. So it was extraordinary for me to think that all these people were going back and helping us to heal. So the novel sort of more or less goes from 1845 all the way to 2012. And then there's another kernel of a story in between about the first transatlantic flight that Alcock and Brown did. And sometimes people ask me, they say, what's this novel about? And I say, it's about 301 pages.
Well, in terms of the transatlantic flight, which I just, it's incredibly vivid. You really feel as if you're in the cockpit with those pilots, you know, as they're experiencing the freezing cold and, you know, they're taking little nips of liquor every now and then to warm them up.
That's right.
They have no idea where they are half the time. It's terrible. You feel their exhilaration and their terror.
Right.
But then I read that you actually, where you write is in a closet in your apartment on the floor.
Mm.
And so I thought, how does this imagination emanate from that little closet on the floor? You know,
right.
So why do you write from a closet on the floor, Colin?
My 14-year-old boy said to me the other day, Dad, are you really in the closet? you know what? I had this office that I redesigned with a friend of mine, and there was a cupboard there, and I extended the desk back into the cupboard, And I just went in there one day and said, oh, this is a nice place to write, because the wall is on either side and you can hardly move, and it sort of focuses and concentrates your vision. And I wasn't looking out the window or anything like that, and it just felt like a good place to write. I have to get up every now and then because my knees or my legs are stretched out in front of me. And
So you've got your laptop on your lap?
Laptop on my lap, and then I play some music in the background, and I sort of just go from there.
Because I actually think it's something a lot of aspiring writers go out and buy themselves a fancy notebook, a beautiful desk, the nicest pen in the world, but really it's all about the work.
It's all about sitting on your arse and and fighting it. And I was talking to the kids today. It was really nice. And by the way, that's an incredible program that they have here in town. To have young people, give them a space to write and give them like the idea that they are valuable and their stories are valuable. And looking in those young faces today, see some of the qualities of these young writers. And I said to them, what you have to develop is stamina, desire, and perseverance. And so much of writing, as you know, is like just sitting down there and working at it.
And I think you said something to them about writer's block.
Yes.
What about it?
I kind of said there's no such thing as writer's block. You have to get in there and you have to just face the blank page until it's not blank anymore. I also told, can I say a bad word? No. Am I allowed to say? Yeah. Can we
bleep? Please do, right?
Can we bleep it out on NPR? I'll tell you that it's a four-letter word that begins with S and ends in T, right? So you can use your imaginations, right? But a friend of mine says, Alexander Heyman, who's a great writer in Chicago, he says, it's all bleep until it isn't.
Right.
And it sounds facile, but in the end, what he's talking about is that you got to fight it, you got to be there, and you got to work it over and over and over again.
And not romanticize the inaction.
Right. Yes, yeah, and you can do. I know when it's going well when I can get up or get out of my closet and go, wash the dishes and go for a run and look after the kids and bring them to school and things. When it's going badly, I just sit there and fight. Sometimes for 12, 15 hours a day. And because you have to, it's like breaking a fever. You have to be able to break the fever.
You have a few kind of icons sort of hanging up in your office, right? Among them, your National Book Award medal.
I didn't even realize it was there until the photographer came in, and then, it was just hanging up right beside me.
Right. But also your father-in-law's shoes.
Yeah. This is, I have a picture of my father-in-law's shoes, and just recently we gave them to the 9/11 Museum in New York.
Do you all know this story? Maybe you could tell the story of...
Well, the story behind it is that on September the 11th, my father-in-law, Roger Hawke, was in the first building to be hit, the second one to come down. He was on the 59th floor. He got out, but he walked out into that... The second building had come down, so he walked out into that glaucoma storm of debris and all that dust and things falling and he was covered in dust, and his shoes were covered in muck from sloshing through the water inside the building. He walked uptown to our place, took off his shoes, left them at the front door. But my daughter jumped up into his arms, and she immediately sort of recoiled after she said hello to him. And I said, "What's wrong with you, love?" And she said, "Well, Poppy's burning." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, I can smell smoke off his clothes." And I said, "Oh, okay, it's all right. There was a fire downtown." She was only three or four. There was a fire downtown, and I wasn't going to go into what was going on. And she said to me, no, you don't understand. He's burning from the inside out." And when she said that, he took off all his clothes, and he actually threw his suit away. He threw his shirt away, he left his shoes at the front door. And they sat there for weeks until my wife, Alison, looked at them and said, "We've got to do something about those shoes," because the debris from the World Trade Center was still on them.
Yeah.
So I just put them in a box and just tucked them in my office. And I wrote "Let the Great World Spin" with those those shoes sort of over my shoulder, thinking that that's some way to... And I suppose it's about trying to inhabit the shoes, not just of him, but of all those people who died. And then later, just recently, as I said, we gave them to the museum in New York. So I have the picture hanging up in my office.
And then as a result of your writing that book, you were invited recently to speak in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, to some of the students who...
That was the wildest and most touching and devastating and beautiful and profound moments of my literary life. I got this letter from a teacher there, Lee Keelock, an English high school teacher, and he said they were looking for a book for the students to navigate their grief over the Sandy Hook massacre for the older students, the 17 and 18 years old, so that they could read the book and then talk to counselors and use it in whatever way they could to get to a moment of healing. And so then I went up there in April and spent a day with the students. And these kids were profoundly brilliant. They would say things to me like, we know that we are shrouded in darkness. We know that we saw the heart of darkness, you know, because they did. They had brothers who had died, sisters who had died. They had babysat for these kids who were now gone. And I tell you, I was sat there and there were tears in my eyes. And then they said, but we're looking for a little bit of available light. And I thought, well, that's it. And the fact that they had navigated some of this mm-hmm. through any of my fiction or through anybody's poetry, it makes you think that literature actually, you know, can do something. Because there are times when you think, oh, is this worth it? But then you have moments like that that change your life.
Well, I also read somewhere that you talked about how easy it is to be cynical and how the more difficult thing in life is to be an optimist.
Right.
And I think that really comes through in your, you know, in your work when you talk about in the new book, the pilots, you know, being optimistic, reaching towards the future.
They took, like the pilots, the Alcock and Brown, they changed the bomb bays on their plane to petrol tanks.
And they're based on real life figures.
Real life figures. But see, when you're an optimist, it's so easy for people to accuse you of being sentimental. You know, especially somebody who's coming from it from a pretend intellectual viewpoint. Because they like to be those squinty-eyed bastards sitting in the corner, you know? Like, they do. You know the person who's at a party? And he's sitting over there nursing his drink, and he's saying, it's all crap. And you stand in the middle of the room as an optimist, and you're sort of exposed in certain ways. So I think that the real value of an optimist is to be able to deal with the cynic. So to be as equivalently open to his or her pessimism and be able to beat them at their own pessimism, leave them there, acknowledged in there, whatever, you know, pessimism they have, and walk away from it and just say, I'm going somewhere new, because, you know, it's really no great revelation that the world is dark and that bad things happen. The true revelation is that you can get something out of the darkness mm-hmm. and go somewhere new. Otherwise, it's not worth it. It's really not. And that's what these kids were talking about. Even though they'd gone through this terrible, terrible moment, they were looking for somebody to come along and say, yes, you're valuable, and your story is valuable, and your ideas are valuable, and your life can be valuable. And I'm prepared to take on, maybe that's my fist fight tonight, I'm prepared to take on the pessimists at their own game. And in other words, by saying, you know, by writing realistic fiction that doesn't shy away from some of the rougher moments of life, but then try to find some joy at the end.
I think you once described yourself as a poetic realist.
Yes.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Sounds nice, though.
It does. I'm maybe a pez optimist or something like that.
Did your parents read to you when you were a little kid?
They did. Yeah.
What did they read you?
My father was a novelist, or well, he was a writer. He wrote 27 books, and seven of the books were kids' soccer books.
And he was a soccer player, wasn't
he? He played in England. And then when I was 8 or 9, the first book came out, and it was about Georgie Good, who was an itinerant soccer player in England. Obviously, anybody knows anything about soccer knows that that name comes from Georgie Best, who was one of the great soccer players of our time. Anyway, he'd give me his books on big reams of paper and asked me to read them. And when the book finally came out, I remember going to school. I went to school in Fox Rock, in a suburb of Dublin, and my teacher, Mr. Kells, told us if we behaved ourselves that he'd read from my dad's book every Friday afternoon.
Wow.
And I do remember Christopher Howlett, a redheaded kid in the class who I've never met since, like jumping up on the desk when Georgie Good scored a goal and going, yeah! And I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. But my parents, yeah, they gave me access to books, and I grew up fairly suburban, middle class, mm-hmm. and I was lucky. I had the world's worst childhood for a fiction writer.
Oh, because it was idyllic?
Because it was happy.
Yeah.
That's what I used
no
to laugh.
No Angela's Ashes.
Yeah, McCourt and myself. I said, McCourt, you got all the misery. I hate you.
You know, that's funny. I interviewed Edna O'Brien recently, and she was not allowed to read books growing up, and she had kind of a miserable childhood.
Right.
But one thing you have in common, I guess, I asked her, why are the Irish such great storytellers? And she said, I think we're all a bit mad.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. There is that madness there. There are so many currents in Ireland. I mean, we have this Hiberno-English, this deep desire to tell a story, a tradition of storytelling that goes all the way back to the Shanachies that used to walk the roads and go from town to town. And I suppose we all also practice it because we were... Or many of us grew up Catholic, so we were telling lies and confessions every Friday. I remember that moment. It's like, I have to go in and tell the priest what the bad stuff I did. I don't want to tell him the real bad stuff I did. So I had to invent, I had to lie to the priest.
Do you want to give us an example?
Yeah, well... I used to, like, shoplift little things from Dunn stores and everything, but I would go in and tell the priest that... I can't even remember what I said to him. I won't tell you what I said to him.
Yeah, I kind of remember going to confession and just being... I think I was recite my sins. I wasn't a storyteller, so I think that's the difference between...
Oh, really? Did you have bad sins? Come on now. It's time for me to interview you.
I was a pretty good girl.
Tell us about your sins.
I was a pretty good girl. And you know what? I got caught at everything I did wrong. So anyway, it's not very interesting. You're in the midst of launching something called Narrative 4, which is about sharing stories as the key to opening the world.
Right.
Right? The tagline, in fact, is fearless hope through radical empathy.
That's correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by radical empathy and what the initiative is?
The initiative is something that I've been working on with Luis Urrea, the Chicago-based novelist, and Lisa Consiglio, who's our executive director. And we recognize the need for young people to share and exchange their stories on a global level. So we want to take kids from Belfast, kids from Haiti, kids from here, kids from New Orleans, and get them together to exchange and own one another's stories. In other words, to step into the other person's shoes. So I would give you my story, and you would give me your story, and then we'd be able to retell them to other people so that it becomes an act, a fearless act of empathy that's radical in the way that we hope to not only like shrink the world in a certain way because it's global, but also expand the lungs of the world because it means that you can become other. Because I think that the most important thing in terms of literature, in terms of thinking, in terms of politics, in terms of social action, is that we have to learn to understand one another. And when we try to understand somebody else's difficulty, I think it just it makes us slightly better people. I was reading about Aldous Huxley recently, and at the end of a long life, a beautiful philosophic writer who tackled all sorts of subjects. He was asked what he had finally learned, from life. And apparently he just sat back and he stroked his chin for a long time and he said, you know what, I think we've all just got to learn to be a little bit better to one another. And that is profound and it's true, you know, but then you have to defend that. Right? And that, and that's the thing. And so I've been lucky. I've had a really good career, and it was time for me to embark on doing something new. There are lots of writers who are involved in good things. Dave Eggers, who's out with 826 Valencia. Roddy Doyle is in Dublin with Fighting Words. And this organization that we're creating is sort of an umbrella organization to bring creative writing groups together and give kids a chance to tell their story. And it works. It's incredible.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
It's really incredible.
You've got some really amazing people involved in it, too.
Yes. Well, we have Sting is going to be in Chicago on Saturday, and he's going to actually sing in front of a couple of thousand kids, brand new stuff. J.J. Abrams, the director, is one of our honorary members.
Gabriel Byrne.
Gabriel Byrne, Salman Rushdie. Like all sorts of people have given us their names, and Gabriel actually wrote a story for Esquire magazine How to Be a Man. Do you want to tell him the story?
No,
I tell him the story?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, something really embarrassing.
And then
happened.
Save a little time for you to read a little bit.
Oh yeah, something really embarrassing happened the other day, but it wasn't embarrassing. It's kind of funny. So we were at this launch of Narrative 4, and Gabriel's there, and there's a reporter there, and she's asking us, what's Narrative 4, and how was it born, and we're talking about it, and we give it the line and all everything, and we're having a great time, and she turns to Gabriel, and he's leaving, and you know who Gabriel Byrne is, right? Yeah, the most handsome actor in the
every
world.
Woman in the room.
Every woman
knows.
He's in treatment, and, you know, and done fantastic films. Anyway, Gabriel sort of, he has a twinkle in his eyes, like, and he turns away with his girlfriend, and he says, she says, how did you meet Colm? He says, oh, I slept with him. I was like, no, she's a reporter. Don't say that. Anyway, the reporter quoted it today. It was very funny.
I'm glad you think so.
That's funny. Anybody who knows me knows it's very funny.
So would you like to read a couple of lines for us?
Sure. Okay, I'm going to get real serious and read about Frederick Douglass for a little while. Douglass was 27 years old. He was an extraordinarily beautiful man, as you know, but we tend to preserve him in that aspect of those photographs or those daguerreotypes that we saw him when he was older, you know, with the long gray hair and the beard and that serious lived-in face. But when he was in Ireland, he was this young man who still didn't know the world in the way that he later knew it and challenged it and wrote about it beautifully. He'd already written Narrative of the Life of a Slave, but Ireland, he said, made him. And he said that when he was under the soft gray skies of the Emerald Isle, and lo, the chattel becomes a man. Part of it was because he was faced with contradiction. And one of the contradictions was he was looking after his 3 million people who were still enslaved. And this is what unfolded at his feet. And it becomes a moral quandary for him. He's out in a carriage. He's in the middle of Ireland. He's with his publisher, Richard Webb, who he doesn't really get along with.
And he's a little bit of a dandy, too, right?
He's a real dandy, yeah. There was a smell out over the land. The soil had been turned. The blight had flung its rotten odor into the air. The potato crop was ruined. It's all they eat, said Webb. But why? It's all they have, said Webb. Surely not. For everything else, said Webb, they rely on us. British soldiers galloped past, hoofing mud up onto the hedgerows, green hats with red badges like small splashes of blood against the land. The soldiers were young and frightened. There was an air of insurrection about the countryside. Even the birds seemed to howl up out of the trees. They thought they heard a cry of a wolf, but Webb said that the last wolf had been shot in the country a half century before. Creeley, the driver, began to whimper that maybe it was a banshee. Ah, quit your foolishness, said Webb. Drive on. But, sir, drive on, Creeley. At an estate house, they stopped to see if they could feed the horses. Three guards stood on the gate, stone-carved falcons at their shoulders. The guards had shovels in their hands, but the handles of the shovels had been sharpened to a point. The landlords were absent. There had been a fire. The house smoldered. Nobody was allowed past. They were under strict instructions. The guards looked at Douglas and tried to contain their surprise at the sight of a Negro. "Get out of here," the guard said. "Now." Creeley pushed the carriage on. The roads twisted. Hedges rose high around them. Night threatened. The horses slowed. They looked ruined. A gout of spittle and foam hung from their long jaws. "Ah, move it, please," called Webb from the inner cab, where he sat knee to knee with Douglas. Under a canopy of trees, the carriage came to a creaking stop. A silence pulled in around them. They heard a woman's voice under the muted hoof shuffle. It sounded as if she were invoking a blessing. "What is it?" called Webb. Creeley did not answer. "Move it, man, it's getting dark." Still, the carriage did not budge. Webb snapped the bottom of the door open with his foot. He stepped down from the inner cab. Douglas followed. They stood in the black bath of trees. In the road, they saw the cold and grainy shape of a woman. She wore a grey woolen shawl and the remnants of a green dress. She had been dragging behind her a very small bundle of twigs attached to a strap around her shoulders, pulling the contraption in her wake. On the twigs lay a small parcel of white. The woman gazed up at them. Her eyes shone. A high ache tightened her voice. You'll help my child, sir," she said to Webb. "Pardon me? God bless you, sir. You'll help my child." She lifted the baby from the raft of twigs. "Good God," said Webb. An arm flopped out from the bundle. The woman tucked the arm back into the rags. "For the love of God, the child's hungry," she said. A wind had risen up. They could hear the branches of the trees slapping each other around. "Here," said Webb, offering the woman a coin. She did not take it. She bent her head instead. She seemed to recognize her own shame on the ground. "She's not had a thing to eat," said Douglas. Webb fumbled in a small leather purse again and held out a sixpenny piece. Still, the woman did not take it. The baby was clutched to her chest. The men stood rooted to the spot. A paralysis had swept over them. Creeley looked away. Douglas felt himself become the dark of the road. The woman thrust the baby forward. The smell of death was overpowering.
That's just... I love that piece of the book.
Thank you.
You're listening to IPR News Radio. Coming up, Colin McCann talks about the book that inspires him more than any other. That's in part two, right here on Interlochen Public Radio.
I was raised up believing I was somehow unique, like a snowflake, distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you'd conceive. And now after some thinking, I'd say I'd rather be a functioning cog in some great machinery, serving something beyond me. But
you're listening to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return to Lee Haber's conversation with Colin McCann, author of Let the Great World Spin and his new book, Transatlantic.
So we've talked a lot about the three or four male characters in the book, but really, this book ends up also being about some pretty powerful women.
Thank you, because this was the thing. When I wrote Let the Great World Spin, I didn't even realize that it was mostly a book about women. And I do not want to invite Dr. Freud into my closet.
Literally into your closet,
literally
into your writing closet.
Yeah, because I love to write about women, and I feel easier in the harness, in the writing harness, when writing from the point of view of a woman. The Douglas section was really hard for me to write. The later sections of the novel, so the first half of the novel is kind of male and non-fictiony. Mm-hmm. The second half of the novel is very female and fictional, but they both fold over onto one another to question one another. And
there's a beautiful thread that goes all the way through.
There is a thread. A thread that terrifies me. There's a letter, that, and I thought at first I'm
which
not.
I think we depicted really well. And
oh, that's beautiful. in O Magazine, whoever the artist was who did this, the illustration. Have a look at it later on, because she captured the novel perfectly. So it was one of those things that really took my breath away when I saw it. But I was scared by. A letter, because I thought, Jesus, a letter, it's a device, you know, and I didn't want to turn it into some Jane Austen 19th right. century novel, you know, and I didn't want to do an email or things like that.
Not to mention that people under 21 probably don't know what a letter is.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. But this letter is an unopened letter, and I won't tell you any more, but when I finally got to the section where it had to be opened, I did not know myself what was going to be in the letter.
Wow.
And I remember that day, and I was really terrified. And when I found out what it was that was in the letter, which is neither too extraordinary nor not too small, I felt, okay, I have the novel now. But it belongs to women. And peace, which the novel is very much about peace and acceptance and moving on, that you think about like the Northern Irish peace process, and Senator Mitchell says this too, it belonged to women. It was women who got out in the streets and said, stop this. It's women in Argentina who carried the photos of their sons, the mothers of the disappeared, and said, look, this is public, this is wrong. And this male point of view that was like, ordering history or thought that it was creating history and also largely involved in the war, I think women have been responsible, certainly in Northern Ireland, for so much of the peace process. Even though Senator Mitchell was the one who sort of orchestrated so much, he knew that he would much have preferred to have the chambers full of those 3,600 mothers who lost sons and daughters. And he would have gotten a much, much quicker peace process if they'd have been allowed in. But I mean, the world goes on, and I'm glad that you say that it's about it's really a novel about the power of women.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm always curious about this because you're right in the throes of the tour and the kind of all the whirlwind promotion, interviews and so on. Are you thinking about your next book as you're touring, or have you done you're done with this book? You're touring. And then you move on and start plotting out the next book.
Someone's going to give me my next book sometime later this evening. No, I have an idea, and it's kicking around the back. What happens is at the end of a novel, it seems to me that you're so exhausted that you've used all of yourself up and you're an empty vessel. And then you start to maybe tour and talk, and then the book belongs to other people. Like, the book is no longer mine. And then people come along and they make sense of it for me. You know, often a writer doesn't even know what it is that he or she has written until afterwards. It's sort of a process of mystery, and then people start to fill it in. They own the book for you, and then I can step away from the book and start to think about other things. So I read poetry, read books, and try to find somewhere where. So I'm sort of taking notes and I have a vague idea of where it is that I want to go. But that's terrifying, too.
And?
Can't tell you. I'd have to kill you.
Right.
And you don't want that to happen.
No.
No, I mean, I have a few ideas. But, I think sometimes you have to hold it close because then you lose it. If you start to talk about it too much.
Oh, absolutely. Totally understand.
And also, there's that thing, that wonderful mystery. And all the young students know this, that you get an idea and you walk around the park or you walk along down by the water and you think, I have this idea now. And then it always seems so fully formed and you know, you feel like it's moving through you. And then you get home to the pad or the computer or whatever it happens to be, and it just doesn't come through your fingers. And you know that feeling, it's like when you're writing a paper, it's like, how come I know all this stuff is inside me, but it won't come out? And so then you have to embark and go deep and fail. And that's why Beckett is interesting to me. He has that beautiful phrase, no matter, try again, fail better. And that's what the process is about, failing better every time. And that's the other thing about success, is that you have to acknowledge that your novels have fallen short of what you dreamed them to be. Because if anyone says, ah, yeah, I wrote the novel that I wanted to write and it's all perfect, they're finished.
Do you have one, this is my last question, do you have one novel that you think of as being the one you go back to again and again for inspiration, that you want to reread, that inspires you every time?
Yes.
What is it?
It's Ulysses. I don't want to sound pretentious, but it is.
You did name a bar after it.
Yes. There's a bar in New York where we go and read from Ulysses every June 16th. But I'll tell you why Ulysses is so important to me. I didn't really read it until I was in my mid-20s, and then I read it in sections. And then about 5 years ago, just before Let the Great World Spin came out, I got sick, and I spent 3 weeks in a hospital with this weird infection in my arm that had actually come from my father's garden from working with roses. My father's a rosarian. Anyway, I read Ulysses, and I began to realize that my grandfather was alive on June 16, 1904, which is when the novel takes place, as you know. My great-grandfather was the same age as Leopold Bloom. Now, I never met my great-grandfather, of course, but I could understand exactly who he was by reading the pages of this great novel, and it created the city for me. And so this fiction, this actually allowed me into my own history. So it's a conjunction of like reading something that's totally imagined, and yet you know it's literally in your blood. It's moving through. And I was sitting there in the hospital. Admittedly, I was on a little bit of morphine and a little bit of Percocet. But my dead grandfather walked into the room and sat down on the bed for a little while. He stank a little bit of whiskey, mind you. But it was it was one of those things where I recognized that I could negotiate my own life through literature, much of the way that we talk about those Sandy Hook kids, maybe being able to negotiate some of their grief through reading something that at first doesn't seem to be, you know, absolutely pertinent to their immediate experience. But literature goes back in and reinvents and retakes, and then we build up all these different layers of our lives. And I think that's part of its beauty, and it's also part of its charm and its difficulty too, as well. So Ulysses, I read every year, and I love doing it. And it's perpetually surprising to me. And the older I get, the more I recognize in it, because it is a vast compendium of human experience. It's also naughty.
Yeah, it is.
And can I just tell you one other story? There's a photograph that they're actually using. It's about 6 or 7 years old for the thing tonight. It was taken by my friend Brendan Burke. My friend Brendan died in early January. He's a good friend of mine. And I'd been at him for years to read Ulysses. Years and years. Really great friend. So I went back to Dublin. And his partner, Liz, she said to me, by the way, Brendan bought Ulysses 2 weeks before he died.
Right?
I was like, ah, jeez, did he read it? And she said, no, it wasn't cracked open. But what she did was, and in Ireland we have this tradition of an open coffin, he was in a wicker coffin, and she placed it on his chest, and I got a chance to sit in with him, before the family came and everything. So I just picked up the book off his chest, and I read him the really dirty parts. Why not?
Thank you. Colm, thank you so much for sitting down to talk. This was really just so much fun.
Thank you. It just flew.
It did.
It flew.
What were we nervous for?
I know. It's great. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, so we'll open it up to some questions from the audience. I think we have about 20 minutes or so for questions. So, yes, over here.
Your prose is magnificent, and it is. There's such a rhythm and a pacing, and I'm wondering, in the process of your writing, how that comes out. How does it spill out? Do you hear it? Do you hear a rhythm? Do you ever read it out loud, or do you feel it in
That's
your...
That's a good question. Mm.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I planted that question, by the way. No, music is really important to me, and the whole thing about being Irish is that, yes, we do have all that music going on, but my kids think I'm completely mad because I do walk around the house reading things aloud. I think getting the rhythm and having the words lift up off the page, and I do think it's like trying to conduct an orchestra, and in the beginning, it's sort of messy, and they're saying, okay, a contrabass goes here, piano here, strings come out here, you know, and then finally you move it all together, but you edit it down. And I also listen to music. So while I was writing Zoli, I listened to a lot of Czech and Slovakian gypsy music, for instance. While I was writing Let the Great World Spin, there was some blues and some jazz that I was looking for. With Transatlantic, it was a lot of Van Morrison and stuff like that. So. Yeah, and I think the music, it sort of inhabits you in a certain way.
Yeah, but I think that was a good, really good question. Who's your first reader, by the way?
My first reader is my wife, Alison. And so that causes a lot of problems at home sometimes. Because she's a brilliant reader, but she's also very honest. And I'll say, I have a section, will you read that? And she'll say, oh yeah, it's good. And I'm like, oh no, it's only good. but she's fantastic, but I'll go around the house afterwards, banging my head off the wall. You don't love me anymore, you know. But I also have numerous readers.
And then after
readers.
You won the National Book Award, you said, "See?"
No, she's always she's a brilliant editor too, and I have an editor in New York, an editor in London. But I tend to spray my stuff around amongst friends. I don't wait till it's finished. And so, like, even when I was writing the Frederick Douglass stuff for this book, I sent it to a Douglass expert very early on. And I thought, oh, this is good. Yeah, it really captures the 1840s in Ireland. And at one stage, I had a woman on a bicycle. And he wrote back to me, he said, by the way, bicycles weren't invented until 1880. I was like, oh, really? I better take that out.
That's interesting. Another question?
I know that you mentioned earlier this evening that you have a daughter who will embark on the college search process in another year. Mm. When she sits down to write all of her college essays, what advice will you give her?
Ah. Okay.
Yeah. Good luck with that one. That's a hard question.
Well, I will tell you that she wrote an essay about herself, and she doesn't want to write, and she says, you know, she wants to be a marine biologist and a radical environmentalist, but she wrote an essay about herself a couple of years ago that I thought was just absolutely phenomenal. And I see college applications every year. I teach at Hunter College in New York. We get 500 applications for 6 places. And these
for the MFA
program. And these personal essays are really important. And how does somebody... But over and over again, I get the regular ones. Yes, when I was 5 years old, you know, I wrote my first story. And I see it again and again and again. As somebody who's prepared to, go under the skin a little bit. And it's really hard when you've got 200 to 500 words to write about yourself. But you do have to work it. But don't necessarily listen to all the college counselors or all the people who are saying that you have to, you know. Really what, certainly for me, if you can thrill me with language and say something that makes you, you know, stand out as different, and if you show that desire and that sort of thing, I think it's fantastic. I think we're way too obsessed with results, like SAT numbers and all that sort of stuff. And really what we want is personality. And I wish we would teach creative writing in a better way. Obviously, you guys are teaching creative writing here, which is fantastic, and not be obsessed with one's own results, but be obsessed with otherness and try to be somebody else. And I think, I don't want to say that that's what you definitely should do if there are students out there and they'll call me up, I didn't get into NYU, it's your fault. But I think a spark of language, I think, is very, very, very important.
Another question?
First of all, thank you very much for Let the Great World Spin.
Thank you.
In that novel, the character Corrigan changes pace and faces many times.
Right.
Is he based on a cleric that you knew, someone from Maynooth perhaps, or is he simply a developmental priest that you wished had been somewhere in your life?
That's a great question. Corrigan is the person that I wish that I could be in a certain way, but I'm much more like his cynical brother, who is much flawed. But it's based on my wife's cousin, Giorgio from Italy, who was with a group called the Petit Frère de Dieu or the Piccolo Frati, which are the Little Brothers of God. And these are Franciscan order who basically, they dress in ordinary clothes, they live in a community, they don't call attention to themselves as members of a religious order, and they try to do good things in the world. And these people exist, and they're out amongst us. They're almost like the Jewish notion, the beautiful Jewish notion of the Lamed Vatnik, which are the 36 hidden saints in the world who bear the sorrows of the world and have a line of communication with God. And I like that notion, but it's also based on my idea of the radical Jesuit priest, Daniel Berrigan. And at first I called him Berrigan, just to find his character, and then I changed it to Corrigan. So he was both of those things. He was like based somewhat on a real person, and then also that person that you would want and imagine them to be. But what I like about all of this is that those people really are out in the world. And at a time when the Catholic Church was being hammered, and rightly so, for stuff that was going on, why not talk about all those good people, those nuns who go down to South America, those priests who are actually doing good things in the world? I think we have to acknowledge that they're at least, there's a line in the book that says there's always room for at least two truths. And that's the thing. If you can carry these different truths, that's the essence of fiction, in fact. Because it doesn't have to be like politics. It doesn't have to be like commercialism or that we take these contradictions, we own them, and we like them. Yeah, the both things happen at once. Thank you.
Anybody else?
I guess on the note of the rhythm of your prose, which I too was very moved by in Let the Great World Spin, I wanted to find out how you experience a book is very subjective and personal, and when you're reading a book, you can let those words sort of roll around in your brain and your heart, musically. And so I wondered how you felt about audiobooks and about another person sort of doing what you just did for us on the stage with that one excerpt, which was so beautifully read. And how
he's got a beautiful voice,
what is,
right?
How attached are you to the rhythm of your own words, I guess?
Funny story. So I wrote Let the Great World Spin, and the opening chapter is from the point of view of Ciarán, who's the brother of Corrigan, right? And I thought, okay, we've got an audio book, and really what they're going to use is lots of different voices. They're going to use an African-American woman, they're going to use loads of different American accents in here. But how about I call up the person at the audiobook thing and volunteer, because I love to read, right? And I'm a bit of a ham, right? But I really do like to read, and I like to capture the music. And I called her up, and she said, oh, you wrote this book, that's great. And I said, yeah, I'd love to read the first section. And she said, oh. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? She said, generally we have people come and audition for this. And I'm like, this is my book. Right? So then I said, okay, I'm going to come down. And I went down to 14th Street, and I auditioned, and I didn't get the job.
No.
I swear to God. I swear
I'm going to check that one out.
It's true. It's
I'm going to check that one out.
It's true. I didn't get the job. You know, I like to hear other people read it, and it sounds different then, and they own it in different ways. The same way that a
reader ended up reading
owns
it?
In different ways, huh?
Who ended up reading it?
You know, I've never listened to it. I haven't listened to it. Now, with Transatlantic, there's an Irish actress, Geraldine Hughes, who I asked if she could read it, and apparently, I haven't heard that. I will listen to that.
Apparently she's
done a beautiful job. No, I said to the audiobook guy, she has to read it. Because she's an actress, she knows. And reading it, you know, it's not the same as on stage, because if you fluff a line, you know. And really, I suppose, I can understand that I didn't get the job, because you do need an actor and a sensibility.
But I think now that you've won the National Book Award...
Maybe. I don't know.
Right. They probably wouldn't make you audition.
I don't know. Maybe still.
Yes, I'm just. My question is, how are you enjoying the process of adapting your book to the screen? I mentioned in the literature that we received tonight that's happening. How's that working for you?
So, Let the Great World Spin has been adapted, and I'm working with J.J. Abrams, and he got a little project that sort of interrupted for a little while. It's called Star Wars. but we're still working on it together, very much, very closely. And I took the book, basically, and held it up in the air and let it fall to the ground, and it smashed, and then we started putting it back together again. And I think that the process of writing a screenplay is interesting, because you've got to murder the book and then recreate it, because you can't be too loyal. I think part of the problem with a lot of book adaptations, especially books that people like tend to like, is that the screenwriter becomes too loyal to the actual story. And really, you got to write... You know, if you've written a book that you like, you should write a film that you like. And I was lucky. He gave me a chance to write the script. I'm not sure when it'll be made, but sometime soon. I like the idea of doing films. But I tell you, it's a miracle that a good film gets made. Because, like, it's not a miracle that a good book gets written, because you're there and you're on your own and you're in control of the weather and all these sort of things. But... on a film, you got actors, you got producers, you got the money, you got the weather, you got like all sorts of things. And so when somebody pulls a film together, it's really an amazing thing. So hopefully it'll work with Let the Great World Spin.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Colin McCann at the National Writers Series talking with Lee Haber. Colin McCann is the author of two collections of short stories and five novels, including his newest, Transatlantic. On the next National Writers Series program, we hear from best-selling author and activist Temple Grandin. Her latest book is called The Autistic Brain. You can find out more about the National Writers Series at nationalwritersseries.org. Thanks to Joe Bears at the Traverse City Opera House. I'm Linnea Milcarrick, and this is Interlochen Public Radio.